But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello, and welcome to The Advice Show, where once again, our Meet the Advice CIO series is hitting the airwaves. I'm very glad today to be joined by Charlotte Watson, the CIO at Attivo Investments. I think that's just get straight into it. First things first, do you mind telling us a bit about your background, how you got into investing? I understand it was from a very kind of early age.
It was, actually. I've had quite a different path, perhaps, maybe. So my parents were in the military, and I grew up all over the world, different countries, different schools. So I was learning about the world and everything from a very early age, because you're experiencing so many different cultures. And then also my uncle was in investment banking as well, and I just loved all the stories that he came back to tell us. And so he was my inspiration. So honestly, probably from about 10 years old, I knew that I wanted to get into investments and finance, which I know sounds incredibly strange and weird. And I haven't really met many people that can say it was from that age. But I just found it so incredibly interesting. And I did a lot of work placements when I was younger. I went to the States when I was 16, to San Francisco. And that was my first experience on a trading floor, which I thought was so exciting. And it was amazing. And then I did placements at Deutsche Bank and Lehman Brothers, obviously, which is no longer here. And did so much research, because I didn't really know what I wanted to do. But I just found that it was so exciting that what happened in the world then impacted investment. So I looked at equities and derivatives and commodities. And then I did my graduate program at Bloomberg, which was probably one of the most amazing things that I did, because you are exposed to every single asset class and every single role in the industry. So whether you're a bond trader, an equity analyst, a portfolio constructor, you're dealing with them on a daily basis, and you have to learn their roles inside out to be able to show them how to use the system. And also, I graduated a couple of years before the financial crash. So my first 5 years in the industry was, you know, resilience, risk controls, you know, you saw it all right from the beginning. So that's been my inspiration, and I've pushed that always along.
Yeah. Well, I suppose it makes a little more sense that if you started at 10, that then became CIO at 28, because it on the surface is a very young age, but that's 18 years of experience. Mm-hmm. What was it like becoming CIO of back then at such a young age?
Yes. When I joined, I didn't actually join as CIO at the beginning. I joined as an investment manager, and that's where I met Stephen Harper, the chairman of the business. And he gave me a chance because he saw my passion for the industry and my skill set. And he wanted to, at that point in time, we didn't have discretionary permission. So we wanted to go and get the discretionary permissions, move away from advisory-led models. And he basically gave me a blank piece of paper and said, please go away and design me something, which I did. And then he gave the trust to me to launch that. So from scratch, we then built, and we covered equities and funds, had my investment managers and equity analyst team. We mostly did UK equities, but a few luxury equities in France, etc. And it just snowballed from there, really. And it's really that understanding the planners and the investment side, because what I didn't say from my career path is that I've done so many roles, from equity analyst to investment manager to building portfolios, to building propositions, to working with financial planning firms. And you really, you say this piece is the advice CIO. It is a very specific person, because you're not just sat on the investment and asset side of the world. you also understand what advice and financial planning is.
Yeah.
What are the conversations that they have when they're sat in front of a planner and talking about goals and pensions and life strategies? So it's being able to bring those both together. And so that first time round, that was what we were able to do, is align, you know, what it is the planners needed to talk about and needed to have to deliver what their clients wanted.
I want to come back to that point on how you kind of communicate with clients in a way that is, as you say, distinct from mm-hmm. other corners of investing. But just to go along with the narrative as we have it. So initially with Attivo, and then the DFM arm there was sold to Quilter in, I think, 2017, relaunched last year, and you came back. What was the process there? What was the thinking, and how were you brought back in?
Yes. So I kept in contact with Stephen the whole time. Mm. But it was actually a personal decision that I made to leave the first time. And it was that I'd met my husband, and he lived in Devon, and I have stepchildren. So it was quite a commute. And so I made the decision that I was going to move to Devon whilst they were young. And I set up my own consultancy business and also worked with smaller financial planning firms there. And of course, in that time, I did lots of exams as well, because I'm strange like that. And like my continuous learning. So I did my level 6 investment compliance as well, so I could have another strand to the business. And then now that my stepchildren are older, I thought I want to go back to it now, because I had quite a pace there. But of course, once you move out of London and certain parts of the Southwest, it's a little bit slower. But it was a great career move for me, because I went in and helped financial planning firms with their models, with their governance, with their compliance, with their investment strategies, with their operations. I went in as a strategic person. So then I thought, well, I'm ready. I'm going to come back to London. And Stephen said to me, actually, we're ready now. We want you to come back here. And it's time. And actually, I think it was the perfect timing, because when we did it before, the world was a very different place. Regulation was very different. Markets were very different. And everybody has continued along that path. Whereas we now get to start with a blank piece of paper, what we have done, in this new era. You know, it's different. The markets are different geopolitically. You've got consumer duty, value assessments. How do you build models and strategies for financial planning clients and really demonstrate that value? And being able to do it on a blank piece of paper, you know, I think that's really exciting and something that we can scale now quite quickly, because we don't have legacy issues. We're just moving forward.
Interesting, because with that blank sheet of paper, you've done something quite different. You've got a co-CIO model with SEI, which is the kind of platform tech and investment giant, and they're kind of enormous. They own, so oversee about $1.6 trillion of assets globally. But you're partnered with them in this co-CIO model. Could you explain a little bit how that works?
Yes, yeah, certainly. So when I was doing the planning last year for setting up the business, I spent a lot of time with planners and asking what they felt was missing in the industry, and whether it was language, whether it was the MPS providers, whether it was price, all of those different things. And so they gave me an idea then of how we could build a proposition differently. But also they wanted a compelling story. They wanted scale. They wanted credibility from day one. And you, how do you do that when you're launching a brand new investment business? So, well, then you think, well, actually, we have the vision. We know our clients. We know exactly what they want and what we want to design. How can we bring that at scale to the market? Well, will you strategically partner with somebody? And actually, this is, you know, it's a relatively new concept, but why wouldn't you do it? You know, it's rather than one great, you have a sum of all great things. You could partner with lots of different asset managers, but it allows you, rather from starting from scratch, that you have the pricing power from day one. You're able to negotiate pricing strategies. You can access managers in different ways. You know, and where the industry is today, most clients will access retail funds through a platform, you know, and that universe perhaps would be 4,000. You know, when we do our research for our mandates for the managers within our funds, you know, you're looking at 100,000 globally to begin with. And obviously that screens down very quickly to a low number. But we wouldn't have access to this. But it is a big decision because it's a strategic decision and you've got to align with that partner culturally. You've got to have the same mindset. You've got to be able to work together and you've got to have the same investment philosophy. So for me, when I was doing my due diligence in the markets, it was, you know, we wanted to concentrate on goal-based investing because that align, you know, when a financial planner is out with a client, they are helping them achieve their goals, their life goals, their objectives. So rather than it being the investment strategy, say, let's do a risk questionnaire, you're 1 to 10, you're number 5, you're going into this. It's what is it? Well, you're saving for your pension and you want to retire at this age. And how do we align with that? So actually that narrowed down the playing field quite quickly because we couldn't align with an asset manager that didn't have the same investment philosophy as us. So goal-based investing, so that's one of SEI's specialisms, and they've been part of the academic studies all over the world. You know, and it's a massive extension of modern portfolio theory. You know, we're looking at resilience and we're looking at factor investing, and you know, there's a whole different approach to it. So that's why we decided that we wanted to partner with them, and then their credibility and scale, and they're a great team to work with. And then also we want to be innovative. You know, I love this industry, but I think there's so many things that need to change and improve. And why not? We're in a modern era now. You know, even if it's technology, infrastructure, AI, there's so many more things that can be done. And also how we then narrate that to the clients, because at the bottom of all of this, we're doing it for the clients. You know, that's whatever story or business line we go down, it's for that end client at the end. So that's why we looked at the strategic partnership, and you know, it's been amazing, and it really has. So it's an extension of our resources, really, if I was to explain it to you, because we have the permissions. We're the investment manager. I lead the investment strategy and the asset allocation and the fund selection. But we're using the institutional access, the manager of managers. You know, SEI are the largest manager of manager globally, and it completely changes the way you can build a model portfolio.
On the kind of nuts and bolts of it, mm-hmm. in practice, who's kind of designing the investment strategy? Who's doing the asset allocation decisions? Are they always in partnership, or will you kind of come up with something, go to them? How does it work?
Yeah, so it works both ways. But for them, it's more the research and the resources and the support. So although we all sit on an investment committee, SEI wouldn't have any voting rights on that investment committee. That's Ativo Investments. But it means when we created our asset allocation that we worked with them to use all their economists and research to come up with our capital market assumptions, which then led to our strategic asset allocation. And then we access the manager of manager through their funds. So it's that infrastructure part, but the decisions and everything lays with the Ativo investment. So it's not an outsourcing. It is a strategic partnership where we get to utilize their research capability and their global scale.
In terms of kind of why this works from an SEI point of view, I think one thing that's interesting is the way that asset managers are increasingly looking to where distribution is and who owns the distribution. Do you think this is something that we're going to see more, these kind of partnerships, these tie-ups between advice firms, wealth managers and asset managers?
Yes, definitely. I think I don't think it's going to be fast because there's a lot of learning I expect to do in that area. But, you know, the traditional role of an asset manager where they have their set of retail funds that they go out and demonstrate it to financial planners and investment managers, that's still a huge aspect, and they'll continue to do that. But people are looking for a little bit more. And also they want to show value. They want to drive down costs. So you can do that by partnering with people. And also for scale and credibility, you don't have to have it all in-house. because obviously there's a cost to doing it all in-house, but also you get to have the best of the best. So I expect we'll see a lot more of, whether it's launching funds together or whether it's that somebody will, for one aspect of their model, say UK equity, they want to partner with a fund house just to manage their UK equity mandate or something along those lines. So the forms and how we'll see it, I think we don't really know just yet, but definitely that partnership is where the industry will be moving.
Interesting. And do you think that is a kind of response to Consumer Duty, which you mentioned before, or kind of the price pressures within the MPS market? Mm-hmm. What's kind of driving that?
I think it's an element of all of it. Pricing for sure, because you need to demonstrate your value. You've got to be competitive in the market. And also, it's gone beyond. It's not that it's the cheapest. That's not what the industry is trying to do here. It's the most value that you get out of something. So if you're partnering with somebody who's got huge expertise and allows you to access things for your clients that you wouldn't otherwise be able to do, that's it.
Thank you for that. We'd love to dig a little bit more into the asset allocation decisions on the ground, if that's okay. One thing that is especially topical right now is diversification. Everyone's talking about it, but how do you think you best, most meaningfully achieve that in today's environment?
Yes, so I love this question. It underpins really our investment philosophy, is diversification. So you absolutely have to be diversified, because markets have changed. And we can see they move on sentiment. They move quite quickly. It's very different now. We have the instant news, which is why it moves on sentiment. So you can see certain asset classes change very dramatically, even overnight. And we've seen with Trump and the tariffs, what happens with markets with a comment at night and what changes in the morning. So when you're building a portfolio, you're using diversification as a way to spread the risk in the portfolio. And traditionally, that potentially would be your equity bonds. And then potentially on top of that, geographical regions or sectors, for example. But I think if you're trying to look at it like that, you're trying to predetermine what's going to happen, which is quite difficult. And actually, you're always left on the back foot, because by the time you make a change, it's because something's happened. So then how do you diversify a portfolio where you want consistent performance, and what do you put into it? And actually, our philosophy is that our portfolios are based on three return drivers. That's the asset allocation, which we've built using capital market assumptions. Then secondly, your factor investing. So we're looking at value, momentum, quality, and low volatility. Mm-hmm. And then thirdly, it's the alpha that you get from the manager of managers, so that you have several mandates in each of the sleeves. So that's your first diversification there. So actually, we're screening all of these investments and funds to look for a track record of going through all market cycles. So we're not going to make a call on a region or on a sector. It's that they've screened through for those purposes. So the fund manager has had consistent performance, and he's stuck with his style over a very long period of time. So I'd never say to you, Joe, we've taken a call on UK equity at the moment or on the US. It's that we're constantly screening, because factors have proven that through all market cycles, you'll get returns from value, you'll get them from quality, you'll get them from momentum. So that's the diversification for that part. So it is a little bit different.
Yeah, a little more sophisticated, I suppose, than the kind of traditional equity fixed income split.
Yes.
In practice, are you seeing kind of material difference? You mentioned the turbulence of this year. Mm-hmm. Have your portfolios performed in a kind of better way than kind of that old fashioned split might have led to?
Yeah. So, what a time to launch a new investment business from the 2nd of January, when we went live, to where we are today. I think we've had three market corrections, haven't we? With it really has been a turbulent time. But for us, it's been amazing because we've been able to demonstrate exactly what we were trying to do. And that is to create a more consistent journey, one that you can explain and align with the financial planning. And yes, to date, our performance has been incredibly strong. They have been slightly smaller on the drawdowns and more consistent in the performance. We split our models between accumulation and preservation. Mm-hmm. So the lower risk models are preservation as a goal and the higher risk accumulation. Mm-hmm. And so preserving for the preservation capital portfolios, we're trying to preserve capital as well as grow it. So we're looking at the potential of losing money as well as volatility. So we're not just using a risk metric there. And then with accumulation, it's that consistent growth. So this is why we're screening all of these investments that we're looking, that we know how they perform in different market cycles.
You mentioned in an earlier interview with Citywire that the status quo has changed, that we're in a new environment now. And you mentioned that there, starting a range at the 1st of January has been quite something. How do you go about communicating that to clients?
So I also think this is a part of the element of consumer duty as well and consumer understanding. But it's trying to bring it to life in a way that relates to the audience. So obviously we deal with the financial planners. So we need to equip them with everything that they need to go out and see the underlying client and all of the literature, all of the explanations. So we do lots of training sessions talking about what's going on in the world, why the models are different. And it really is why we created it in the first place. We stood up at the beginning and said the world has changed and, all of these events that are happening, geopolitical. A lot of clients who are in advice, they're near retirement. So that the journey matters to them incredibly. They're the type of clients that potentially could take something out of their pension which hadn't been planned. And so if you are, and like we've said, it's now very volatile, mm-hmm. then you could think there's a chance that a client could take out something when the market was down by a huge amount over a week. So you want to try and create a more consistent journey, which is where we are. So it's trying to explain that in a way that brings it to life for the client. So to use better language, to make it exciting, to make it interesting for people, and really to demonstrate what that USP and what that difference is to where they are today.
And do you find the clients are adapting to this new environment, of heightened volatility?
I think so. It is, again, it's talking to them about it. That's what it is, because it is different. Yeah. We've had so many different market cycles, but it is now very much that we're looking at up and down all the time. So it's talking about that and to say, actually, we're looking at long term investing. This is really just noise that's in the background. And although we all need to know about it and we need to be able to explain and articulate it in a way that gives clients comfort and understanding, the bottom line is that we want to stay invested for that long term. So that's where you're talking about the goals, is that we're taking them along a journey so that they can achieve those goals.
Right. Thank you. Looking within those portfolios, you have an Apex range, which is a little more unconstrained and includes some maybe more exciting asset classes like private equity or hedge funds. Within that range, are there any tactical bets or strategic convictions that you have at the minute?
So our Apex is actually very exciting. So a little bit on the background of that is that we wanted something that was a little bit more advanced for planners to talk to clients that have a greater understanding about investments and they want to know a little bit more about what's under the bonnet. So our core range is our standard range, and then the Apex is that bit with something different. So when I talked about our three pillars of returns, these portfolios are based on exactly the same thing, but they add a tactical element into them. So we have our strategic asset allocation in the core models, and we have exposures to all the different factors in there. But when you come to Apex, we then also look at asset allocation and factors in a tactical way. So we have additional sleeves. So one of them is our liquid alts, and that is a hedge fund replication strategy. So that allows us to replicate the underlying of the hedge fund strategies of some of the greatest hedge funds in them. And then we have the factor allocation and asset allocation. So that's where we'll make a call if, so at the minute, it's very much we think that still inflation is stickier and around for longer, and interest rates higher for longer at the moment. So it means that we could use interest rate swaps or derivatives to play our view. So that's where it gives us a tactical amount, because our strategic asset allocation is never going to change very much, because as you remember, we've based it on capital market assumptions. That's a very long-term vision. So we're not going to be every quarter making changes to that. I don't think we'd ever make too many changes. But because we do the fund, the manager of manager, if you think in one of our sleeves, we might have six or seven managers running a mandate into there, and they're making their changes all of the time. But for the Apex, that bit is incredibly exciting. So it means that on a monthly or quarterly basis, or even daily, that trades can be done to benefit from something that's happening. But still, we keep our long-term strategic view. We're driving returns from there, and then this gives us an extra element.
That does sound fun, though. Are there any other kind of recent decisions that you've made or kind of assumptions that you're working on to try and get that edge?
Oh, I mean, all of the time we're looking at the... I mean, I could say an exciting story at the minute, because obviously we do the factors and the quality, value, momentum. Actually, one of the stocks which you probably would have heard of is this crazy trend that's going around at the minute, the Labubu.
Oh yes, the dolls.
Yeah, yep. That people clip onto their handbags, etc. And so that's Pop Mart listed in Hong Kong, and we've had a holding in that, and that's gone up 500% over the last year, I think it is, which is absolutely crazy. But we've reduced that holding over time, because you know, the more momentum it gets, the riskier that it is. But that was a really interesting position.
Yeah, that is fun. Moving on ever so slightly to a kind of, I suppose, a little more personal question in terms of kind of what motivates you as an investor. What kind of gets you up in the morning to do your job?
Gosh, there's lots of things, because genuinely I love it. I really have such a passion for this industry, and I think there's a number of things. First one is the ability to improve and to change. I know, I think that's really exciting right now. There's so many opportunities to innovate and create something better for the end client, and for those planners to be able to go out with truly something that they believe and confident in. And so, you know, this is stage one of Ativo Investments with our MPS solutions. And so that's exciting. That makes me want to get up every morning. And also, secondly, I think it's that ability to give people the confidence to stay invested, because that's what a planner has to do, that when they're out with a client, it's being able to explain these complex investments and explaining the market cycles, and so that the client are confident that their investment is being looked after, and that they can avoid the noise slightly, because they know actually the rationale behind this. We understand it and we believe in it.
Now, a question I've asked everybody in this series is your best and worst investment decisions. Your best, that you might have already said, it might be those Labubu dolls. But if not, could you give us your best investment decision?
Yeah, so I thought actually I was going to answer this in a slightly different way. I have my worst stock, but for the best one, actually, my best investment is that it's decided to look at investments in a global way, mm-hmm. and not to look at it as sector or regional. I think it really is a game changer, that when you are then screening globally the entire world for proven stocks and proven fund managers, so that they're able to produce those returns through all market cycles, when I know that we're going to be in a very volatile environment. I think that's the best investment, you know, rather than picking one, because it's not like that. You're consistently screening and researching in such a way that you're getting strong returns irrespective of what's going on in the market.
That is interesting, because do you think there's a flaw in looking at investment decisions geographically, insofar as, you know, everyone knows that the FTSE 80% or whatever of its income comes from overseas, the global supply chains are so interconnected, as tariffs are revealing. Is it to an investor's detriment to think about things on a country-specific basis?
I think it's just a different way of doing it. And I think, you know, you do your research, you do your metrics, you do your numbers, and there's lots of different ways to approach it. So I wouldn't say that it was the wrong way, but I feel more confident doing it in this respect, because you're not making calls which potentially could go wrong. If you've made a region call, then you've got to make a quick decision to reverse that, but it's usually after the fact. Mm-hmm. You can't, because investing is an art as much as it is a science. You can't guarantee anything. And so, I wouldn't say it was a wrong way, but I feel very much that this now is the way forward. And it's not just that, it's the institutional investing as well. The diversification that you get from having, you know, six or seven different managers running different mandates in one fund, you know, it's incredible, and they're billions and billions of pounds. You know, it's not just a retail fund. Those institutional mandates are being used in endowment funds, in pension funds globally. So the holdings that you have, there's so many of them. You know, if you were to compare ours with an average MPS, our holdings are going to be so much higher. But that's because they're billions and billions of pounds.
And now your worst call.
Right, worst investment decision. So, I did have this one. So actually, this was it was a direct equity. So this was back in 2015, and it was Volkswagen. Oh, wow. And so there was the diesel emissions scandal. Yes. And they, I can't remember exactly, but they'd done something to the technology, so it wasn't detecting the correct emissions on there. And of course, it was a European company, strong global brand, strong fundamentals. You know, everything on the metrics said it was a fantastic company. And then that was probably my first bit of the risk management. Actually, you've got to think beyond the metrics. You've also got to look at the reputational risk, the ESG risk, because the brand damage from that was huge. I mean, it dropped 30%, I think it was, in a week. There was lots of lawsuits. So obviously, we came out of it straight away, and I think the news came out overnight. But again, that also, these types of things solidified my thoughts on diversification. And actually, why would you hold perhaps a handful of equities? Because if something goes wrong, then that's, you're exposed to that, aren't you? Whereas in the £1 billion mandates, you're going to have thousands of equities in there. So if that happened, you're quite protected from that. But yeah, so that was, I'll always remember that, always.
Would have been tough. For our last question, something a bit unrelated to investments, what do you do in your free time? If you have any.
Yeah, well, I think it all merges into one, really. But again, I'm quite weird. I love doing everything. And so, because I live in Devon, we do a lot of coastal hiking, coastal walking. We'll go out. I've got a little Italian greyhound, and she comes out walking with us. I love hosting. We have people to stay, travel. I read so much. I love reading. So anything from, I've just come back from Greece, and whilst I was there, I read the playbook to private equity. I read financial numbers for entrepreneurs. And so I'm always
on brand.
Always. But I think learning, it's everything you can do. You know, none of us should sit still, really. The world is evolving. We should be evolving. I've been reading a lot about AI as well, and how to make sure that as a company and the industry that we're using that. So lots. I train a lot as well. I do crazy boot camps at early hours of the morning. I'm always on the go and socializing.
That's the way to be.
Mm-hmm.
Well, fantastic. Charlotte, thank you so much for your time. It's been great to chat.
But today is VE Day. The war is
the newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has
tearing
landed.
Down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, The Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.